to introduce you. It's been a great week at the Acid Ideas Festival. And moderator Levi Sell was senior advisor of Global Strategy for International Medical Corps, Pulitzer Prize winning human rights professor at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government, and president of Human Rights First. So I'll leave it to Levi.
Yeah, when you said Pulitzer Prize and you didn't say Samantha, I thought maybe I had won that. And
I was really thrilled.
It was terrific. Boy, welcome, everybody. We're really happy you're here. Can everybody hear okay and everything? No, you can't hear it. You really can't hear? It's not a mic.
Oh, it's not?
So, no, these aren't amplified. This is just because they want it for the tape, you know, for this could be a really, I'm sure this could be picked up by CNN and everything. Anyway, can you hear better now? If you can't hear well, actually move closer. Come on up. There's a couple seats here. You can sit on Susan's lap. But anyway, on behalf of the Aspen Institute, welcome everybody. We're really happy you're here tonight. And just a little bit about why I'm here, and then we'll get to Michael and Samantha, and we'll get to you. But I do want to say, because it's been very aggravating to me in many sessions, if you have cell phones, Blackberries, electronic fax machines, you know, anything like that, turn them all off, because you know what? All your problems will still be around in an hour. I can assure you of that. I just want to start personally and why I'm here. It was the summer of 2004, and I started hearing about Darfur, or spring of 2004. I knew nothing about it. And I started hearing about it on the news, and as I learned about it, I wasn't all that interested. I say that in kind of an embarrassed way to you now. But I grew to hear and learn more, and I'm Jewish. And no matter how much we rewrite history, the world did stand by during the Holocaust till America came in at the end, but fundamentally stood by. And I'm old enough, as most of you are in this room, some are not. Alex, you were too young, so you don't get any of the blame. But even though President Clinton may take the blame, everyone in this room was alive, and most of us were adults in 1994 during the Rwandan genocide. And I, Levi Sell, who like to think of myself as being involved, I didn't do anything. And so here comes Darfur. And I started to hear more and more about it. And I said, what can I do? What part can this rabbi, this teacher, how can I be involved? What could I possibly do? So to make a long story short, I found out about International Medical Corps, which is a humanitarian group like many that do great work. We're not here to discuss that tonight. I went to them and said, I want to go and spend Yom Kippur, which is the most sacred day in the Jewish calendar, in Darfur, being with the people. They first called the psychiatric hospital to see, you know, why is this guy here? And after careful screening, I couldn't go to Darfur initially for security reasons, but I went to Chad, and I was in three refugee camps, Kunungo, Malay, and Omnibok. We'll talk more about them. And I went for the following reasons, and part of what I want you to think about tonight are some questions, because I think everyone here tonight is probably against genocide. I think everybody here tonight probably knows something about Darfur. I don't think anybody came to give the argument that we should kill more people. I think you're probably, you know, we're preaching to the choir, but we're going to do something, I think, very interesting tonight. Part of what's on my agenda, why I went, is the following. What does it mean to be a human being in this world of 2006? What does it mean to have a conscience? What does it mean to care about people we'll never meet or we'll never see? I've now been in Darfur. I've been to Darfur. I've been to Chad twice. Mm-hmm. I will again be sitting on Yom Kippur in refugee camps in Chad, and I will do that until this genocide is over. But I think the question that we all raise is, part of it is, what can we better do? What can the United States do? What can the world do? But what I'm also going to ask is, what is the indifference, even though we heard many questions at the Ideas Festival, we heard a question of President Clinton earlier today about Darfur, I think this is very personal. I think this is about us. I think this is about our conscience. And just finally, before I ask Michael one question, ask Samantha a question, then maybe one other, and then I want to open it up to you. And again, I'm a big believer in questions. I'm a big believer in being succinct. And because I think from Samantha and Michael, we have a lot to learn from. They have a lot of experience, and I want us to get there. But a lot is about, what do we want to be remembered as a people? We are at a very important moment in history. A lot of great things have happened in the movement about Darfur and stopping this. But nowhere near enough. There's not a time to take self-satisfaction, and there's a lot of work yet to be done. I hope tonight will stimulate more of a conversation, more of an involvement, and more information about what's going on. So, Michael, I'd like to start with you. If you could just take 3 to 5 minutes and fill us in on, I read your letter that you sent to the Secretary General recently, both Samantha and I read that, of the situation now in Darfur, and if you could just kind of bring us up to date of where we are right now.
Sure. As I'm sure people in this room know, there is a three-year-old conflict in the western part of Sudan called Darfur, which has pitted a repressive government and its emissaries or its allies, the Janjaweed, a militia, against a population which has been decimated by violence. Probably 200,000 people have died. The numbers vary widely, but there's clearly a huge amount of loss of life. And there are 2 million people plus who've been displaced from their homes. The Janjaweed come into villages, rape women, kill people, burn down the villages. So there's really been a mass devastation of this region. Some of the refugees have now spilled over into Chad, so it's taken on a regional character. There's three aspects of what I think we ought to be talking about tonight. One is the humanitarian piece. There's really a humanitarian emergency which is growing every week and which, despite efforts by private groups, by governments, by the United Nations, is increasingly difficult to meet the need. The UN has unbelievably not gotten the money it needs and had to cut food rations. More importantly, a lot of the private agencies that are there have had to evacuate international staff and in some cases stop working altogether because the security situation is so terrible. So piece one is the humanitarian crisis, which is really escalating and will do so in the next several months, I think, quite dramatically. The second piece in terms of what I hope we talk about is the diplomatic side, the political side. The UN has anointed or passed over to the African Union, the regional political group of African states, the primary responsibility for working on a peace agreement. In May, they met in West Africa, some of the parties to the conflict, and arrived at some kind of a peace agreement that included some power sharing, some efforts to redistribute or distribute wealth. But the agreement was only signed by one of three main rebel groups. The Janjaweed weren't party to it, and they have their own agendas independent of the government. And the 2 million refugees were also not represented. So almost as the ink was drying on this agreement, parties that weren't there started to say, this is not what we bargained for, and we're not going to accept it. So it's really been a almost stillborn effort to find a diplomatic solution. The United Nations is working awkwardly with the African Union because the Sudanese government has said they don't really recognize the UN as a legitimate political player because this is an African problem. So one of the things we're dealing with here is how to overcome this notion that this is an African problem and the rest of the world should not be participatory. The third piece, and let me say one other thing about the diplomatic side. There has really been no discussion, no serious discussion within Darfur among the various factions. And one of the things we've been calling for is a Darfur to Darfur dialogue, trying to get the various parties of interest to actually be in the same room to talk about what do you want? They're rebel groups fighting against the government, fighting with each other, the Janjaweed and the government. All of these forces are operating in a kind of chaotic way, and the people who live in the region are the victims of this mess. The third piece is the need for peacekeeping force, and there clearly is. For the last, I guess, year and a half, the African Union has had a very anemic force, well-intentioned, but about 7,600 soldiers. With a very limited mandate. Many of them are Rwandan, some of them are Nigerian. The troops themselves, I think, are in good faith trying to do what they can, but their mandate through the African Union is really to observe and to protect UN observers on the scene, rather than to protect the civilians whose lives are being put at risk. And so there has been an effort in the last 6 months in earnest at the UN to have the UN come and supplement and effectively transfer that peacekeeping role and to have a more robust and a larger force of 20,000 or more. To date, and as recently as this week, the government of Sudan has said, we will not accept a UN force. President Bashir met with Secretary General Kofi Annan earlier this week in Africa, and he said in very clear terms, we're happy to extend the African Union. They're doing fine, but we don't want a UN force. And the UN has said, all right, let's keep talking. So that's where we are. I think that's pretty...
Well, I would like us to get to all three tonight, Michael. I think we have time to. Thank you. And let me... Now, Samantha, I want to ask you a different kind of question. Again, okay, over here is Michael Posner on my right. This is Samantha Power on my left. Were you joking? Or?
No.
Oh, you were. Okay. Oh, did you miss the introduction? It's okay. We can. Liz had done it, but it sounded like it was all about me, the Pulitzer Prize and everything, but it wasn't all me. Okay, Michael is the president, I just wanted to look at my notes again, of Human Rights First. He's been a human rights activist for 25 years. Is that good enough? Samantha Power is a professor at Harvard. And maybe with that, I'll just turn to it. Samantha, as one might say, human rights is your business. I mean, you're a scholar. You teach at Harvard, all the human rights. But I know Darfur has really touched you personally and a tremendous impact on you. Can you talk a little bit about why it's different or has hit you in a different way than all the other things you've written about, why it's been that for you?
Well, I wouldn't say... I mean, it's hard to do sort of comparative genocides, on, I have to say.
Well, it seems like this one has had more of an impact on you.
For me, the foundation, if we want to, there's nothing like your first love, there's nothing like your first genocide. So for me, actually being a 22-year-old kid in Sarajevo and watching Muslims die simply because they were Muslims and watching NATO planes fly overhead and being there with those people was, I mean, that was the foundational experience of my life. I'll never experience anything like it, I hope, again. But I spent, you know, my 20s first covering the wars in the former Yugoslavia and then trying to piece together a century of bystanding in the face of genocide, American bystanding, trying to understand the gap between the promise of never again, which is enshrined not only in our textbooks, but inexplicably, but kind of bizarrely in a museum on the Mall in Washington with Jefferson and Lincoln and Washington. And then there's the Holocaust Museum. I mean, it's a monstrosity committed against foreign victims at that time by a foreign government, and yet it is enshrined, frankly, right where it belongs. But still, it's a little weird. And so what I spent, you know, 6 years doing was talking to American policymakers about why they had stood idly by. Those policymakers have been groomed on the same Holocaust documentaries that all of us have been groomed on, read the same textbooks. And yet when Rwanda occurred or when Bosnia occurred or when the Khmer Rouge took power or when Saddam was gassing the Kurds, all of us, you know, in government or outside, have found ways to tell ourselves that what is occurring is somehow different from that which we said we would never again allow. So I had written this book, and the book had this really surprising sort of life that I hadn't expected at all. Mike knew me when I was working on the book. I mean, I could hardly find a publisher for the book, and never mind imagining that it would be acclaimed in any way. I mean, it wasn't even thinking those terms. I was just trying to figure out, again, this gap between principle or promise and practice, but really more self-perception and practice. You know, how do we continue to think of ourselves as this innocent country that would do something in the face of genocide? Anyway, to your question, so I finished this book, and then young people start taking up the central lesson of the 20th century is that the battle to stop genocide is lost in the realm of domestic politics. That ultimately states are never, not the United States, not any state, not democracy, not dictatorship, no state is going to gravitate toward putting national treasure on the line to stop the extermination of peoples abroad. It's just not what states do, unless there's some nexus with an economic or a security interest. The exception where states do step up to the plate is when there is sustained domestic political pressure of the kind that Lawyers Committee or Human Rights First have tried to wage, is the kind that many of us in this room, through our postcards and our green bracelets, you know, have tried to mount in the face of atrocities in Darfur. So in Bosnia, you saw a very belated intervention, and President Clinton today packaged that intervention as one that came about, you know, for, you know, organic moral reasons. Would that it were so. I mean, ultimately, Bob Dole, a presidential challenger, and a huge number of bipartisan actors in Congress and outside made it politically impossible to continue to stand idly by in the face of those atrocities. 3.5 years into the creation of concentration camps, into the siege of Sarajevo, into all the things I don't need to bore you with. So this movement sort of takes hold, and people start saying, look, if we want genocide stopped, we got to own this. Like, our foreign policy is in our own hands. And we have been, you know, American leaders have invoked the American people as an alibi for doing nothing. They say, well, the American people aren't interested. Well, and so then a group of you are sort of saying, no, actually we are, in fact. We'd kind of like our country to stand for something. It's a radical idea, but, you know, giving agricultural credits to buy American farm products to Saddam Hussein while he's gassing the Kurds is not actually the foreign policy that we have in mind for ourselves. Allowing, you know, going to the United Nations and demanding the withdrawal of UN peacekeepers from Rwanda in the midst of the fastest killing spree of the 20th century is not what we have in mind for American foreign policy, et cetera. So all this movement started taking hold. So I then say, okay, great, this thing has a life of its own. Now, there's this other issue, which is that the United States is one country among many that we hope will play a role in actually tending to these things. I feel like somebody needs to write the first thing that has been written that is actually readable about the United Nations. So I go off, and I'm minding my own business. The Darfur movement the anti-genocide movement is taking hold. People are applying the lesson of the 20th century. And I want to go write another book that actually gets into, like, how we fix the UN and how we make it a viable entity to actually tend to these kinds of crimes. And then Darfur happens, and I'm trying to write my goddamn book, and there's this thing, the thing is, to do a reported book, you got to kind of go underground, and you got to talk to hundreds and hundreds of people. And Nick Kristof starts writing these things, and I'm like, oh, now I got to write an epilogue to A Problem from Hell, and now it's happening again, and the movement is happening, but it's not quite happening, and all I want to do is just, I got to get this other thing out there because I think it could be useful. And I'm sitting with my mother reading the New York Times, and Nick has his second column. This is in this March of 2004, so it's already almost a year into the killing in Darfur, but it's only his second column, and he was streaks ahead of everybody else, as we know. And my mother folds up the paper, and she says to me, Samantha, it's official. You're a bystander. I was like, Mom, no, you've got to be kidding. So I go, anyway, I've got to wrap up the story. So I go to Chad for the New Yorker, and they're incredibly welcoming of the idea of doing it. I mean, there is a major issue with the media and gatekeeping, and we can talk about that in the discussion. And I go to the refugee camp, and I decide I'm going to sneak into northern Darfur, and then from Chad, and then across the border illegal, and then I'm going to go back to Khartoum and do it the legal way and go down to South Darfur. So in Chad, I told a story today to these guys who are doing a documentary about Brian Steidel, this African Union observer who is, we should credit for a lot of the activism that exists. But I meet a refugee who says that her son has been beheaded in a town called Furrowia inside North Darfur. And so she tells me this, and I have the New Yorker fact checker department in my mind, knowing that, you know, no court of law has a higher evidentiary standard than the New Yorker fact checkers. So you can't just go on the basis of what a refugee tells you. And all of us who've encountered refugees who have suffered these experiences have had the experience. I call it the nah factor. Nah. You know, no, you weren't just sitting at a well minding your livestock and watering your livestock, and the Janjaweed just came up and they beheaded your six-year-old son. Like, nah. You know, and yet you know, because you've seen case after case after case where these kinds of crimes are committed. So you try to wrap your mind around it, but you can't quite, and you hope it's not true. So I decide to, basically she draws me a map of this place, this hillock, where the wells were in this town called Furrowia. And she says, here are the three wells, and here's where we were, and here's the hillock. And I went and I hid behind the hillock. And then my son, Muhammad, you know, was, I heard screams. And it wasn't until the next day that I felt comfortable that I could come out and try to find my son. And I didn't find my son. I only found his head. And then she tells me the story, and she says, and I took his head, and I put it in a bag, and I traveled with my three other kids, and we went off, and we buried, you know, my son. And she's telling me the story, and I just, oh, this is it. I mean, this is what it's all about. So I go to have this little Treasure Island map and very, very unsophisticated journalistic habits that I've developed over the years, and drive into North Darfur, and it takes, I'm with John Prendergast of the International Crisis Group, many of you know, I'm sure, and we drive for 3 days, and for a wea, it sounds a lot like far away, so it becomes this almost mirage in the desert where we're trying to find, we've got this pathetic, you know, little map in a spiral notebook, and we get to this village, finally, and we say, look, you know, where the wells? Can you take us to where the wells are? And this guy takes us, and he takes us to a hillock, and he says, here are the wells, and he points to the sand. You're in the middle of the Sahara. I mean, it's like, you know, no place on earth. And he points to the sand, and I'm, you know, irritated with my translator in a hurry. I've got so much reporting. I just, no, wells, not sand, wells. And he's pointing, you know, and I'm like, I don't know. Wells, and he takes me and he physically like brings me to the spot, and he says, and he points, and I'm like, and I look and I see that sure enough, exactly where she said this farming lady had drawn the map, just so, and what I had thought to be sand, I could just see the trace, the rim of these three wells, but you could hardly see it, because what they had done after burying the other parts of Muhammad, her son, and the other people who were killed in this massacre, they had stuffed the bodies into the wells, and then they had covered them in sand. So there was nothing left of the well. Like, all you could see was just this trace of what was. And it was a twofer for the Janjaweed, because it was simultaneously burying their tracks with, you know, ironically, the great tribute to international justice is not that people stop committing these crimes, but that they've gotten a hell of a lot better at covering their tracks. Hopefully the day will come where they'll also, you know, the voice inside their head that says the Hague will make them stop committing the crimes, but they were deliberately burying the evidence, and simultaneously, a crucial tool of genocide or destruction, you make it impossible for people to move back to this area because you've polluted the water sources. And that is destruction of life. So with Amina, is her name, and Muhammad in my mind, I guess you could say, I mean, that was, it's just like, it's happening again. It just happens and it happens and it happens. So what's amazing, though, is what's different about this genocide, and we'll talk about policy and what needs to be done and everything, I'm sure, in a second, but is we've never had a movement like this. We've had, over the course of the last decade or two, phenomenal human rights reporting, much of it in real time when these atrocities have occurred, but we've never really had foot soldiers to hand the reporting to who then go and make the phone calls and create the political pressure in real time. Now, it's slow. We're already 3 years in, so it's not, you know, rapid fire. And if Darfur had lasted 100 days, our record would be every bit as deplorable as that in Rwanda. But nonetheless, this movement, I think, is worth taking note of. And for those of you who are despairing, as I am most of the time, one thought experiment one has to do is, what would Darfur look like if there were no domestic political pressure? And as bad as it looks, it's hard to do that thought experiment. It's hard to imagine it looking worse. But believe me, the Sudanese government know that they're being watched, and you know, whatever mitigation has gone on, however those refugees, as deplorable as the circumstances they're living in, they would not have any rations, never, you know, half rations, full rations, no, you know, no protection, no African Union, no nothing, if not for this movement that I think has begun to apply the lessons of the 20th century.
Thank you, Samantha.
Sure.
I just want to add, in case you haven't read it, I think the best piece on Darfur is Samantha's article in New Yorker, right? From the New Yorker in August 2004 is her analysis of the situation in Darfur. It's changed a lot, but that, if you have not read it, get that piece. I want to just make one comment. I'm going to ask each of you.
What's it called?
It's
Dying in Darfur, somehow.
Definitely get it and read it. It's really an important piece. I'm going to ask them each a two-minute question, which is going to be out of the norm for each of you, because I like to do that. And then I know everyone here, we're going to want to ask them questions like, what policy should we take to end this genocide? We're going to want to ask some very direct questions, because I love ideas, but with Darfur, we need more than ideas. we need to really deal with that. So I know we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that in just a minute. I want to just deal with the first part of what Michael said about humanitarian, because we're going to go way beyond that tonight. Being in the ground, doing humanitarian work, and here I think I speak for all agencies that are just doing pure humanitarian work, we're facing really tough times. We're facing, I now heard today, in Darfur, we're now facing malaria. We faced great difficulty getting food, water in, building fresh water wells, great crisis. We have a country at war, as you all know. We can't spend all that money at war and have enough money to help us in the humanitarian efforts. The UN has hurt us. There is a great need, and here tonight I endorse no particular humanitarian agency except to say, pick a good one. They're all transparent. You can go on a variety of searches, just like you invest in the stock market. Pick a humanitarian agency that gets a high rating. Anyone that doesn't have more than 85 cents on the dollar going to the field, don't give to them. Look at their track record, and even if it's a household name, don't just take it. Look them up, but they need money, they need your support, and they need your help to do the humanitarian work that we're doing. But here's the question, and then we're going to go on to your questions. And this is a two-minute question. I'll start with you, Samantha, and then you to Michael. This is not a question born out of naivete, but one I wrestle with every night, having seen much of what you describe, Samantha, Michael, knowing what you deal with. I like to read literature, and to me, one of the greatest pieces of literature all time was the Bible. Some of you may remember it. The first brother kills the first brother. Cain kills Abel. How is it, what is it about our nature that here we are, we have evolved so far technologically, in every way scientifically, and our world is filled with more crisis spots than ever? What is it about our nature and that we keep doing this to one another? And here I'm not looking for an analysis of the oil flowing to China and all that. I'm asking now about human nature. If you could reflect on that just for a minute, Samantha, and then you, Michael.
I think fear is a very bad advisor. And one of the things that genocidaire extremist leaders who are motivated by a range of concerns, often that have nothing to do with ethnicity or religion or any of the grounds that genocide is usually predicated on. But one of those people, the things that those people do is they use usually very limited sources of media to create the specter that if you don't kill, you will be killed. And usually there's a shrinking economic pie, as there is in Darfur, thanks largely to one of the themes that's come up throughout this last few days, which is global warming. Mm-hmm. The desertification has created a much smaller pie and much fiercer competition. I just think you plant that idea. You usually invoke past massacres that have actually occurred for whatever reason, and you create the impression that it's lying around. I mean, Hitler invaded Poland on self-defense grounds. He convinced half the German army that Poland was invading Germany. You know, and it's amazing what manipulative leaders, charismatic leaders can do with the tools of the media. I just would push back a little bit and simply say, and maybe it's just my cynicism in my old age, but I don't, to me, that mystery has ceased to be interesting. To me, the greater mystery is why 100 people are here on a Friday night wanting to talk about Darfur, and why 75,000 people gathered on the mall, you know, to protest a crime that had nothing to do with them. 75,000 people who've never met a person from Darfur. That's the affront to human nature that I'm much more interested in, because I think you can count on greed and fear and a desire for territory or power or whatever to be with us, you know, in the Washington form or in the genocidal form, you know, for time immemorial. But what's interesting is when you start to see institutions put in place and people demanding more from those institutions to actually tend to these crimes. That's, to me, the greater miracle and the thing that we have to take.
No, I think you're right.
From.
That is the greatest miracle, a greater miracle, but I also attribute it to great human kindness, because for me, ever since I've been going to Chad and Darfur, I don't get invited to dinner parties anymore. So to me, it's extreme kindness that people would come out and listen. No, thank you. But Michael, do you want to reflect on that for a minute? Then we're going to open it up to all of you.
No, I just would add to what Samantha said. My own experience in dealing with these issues was actually in Uganda in the mid-1970s. I spent about 8 months writing a book about Idi Amin in 1974. Mm-hmm. And, you know, compared even to the Yugoslav example or Rwanda, the only publication in the world, as far as I know, that was writing about Idi Amin was a British humor magazine called Punch, which had a weekly or monthly column with Idi Amin in dialect. It was a humor magazine. And I'm sitting there, I interviewed about 150 Ugandans, all of whom had lost fathers, brothers, sisters, every one of them, had families decimated. By the end of it, 500,000 people were probably killed. There was one other British journalist, to be fair, for The Observer, a guy named David Martin. But I was, you know, again in my 20s, and I'm going, where is the world? How is this happening? So to me, again, I'm sort of with Samantha. I've seen the evolution from that to the Yugoslav discussion, which at least was a discussion, to where we are today, says that the world is waking up. Now, we got a long way to go. We haven't gotten there. But the fact is that there is pressure being applied on the American government, and we need to do more because they're not doing enough. And we can make a difference here. And that, to me, is the heartening thing about this evening.
All right, I want to open it up to you. Remember, questions, I'd like them to be succinct. Samantha and Michael, and I'd like to try and get in 5 or 8 questions in the next 20 minutes or so. And I'll try and call on as many people as I can. If you just say your name when you ask the question. And do it, if you could do it so everyone could hear it, so I don't have to repeat it. Stand up real loud.
Okay. My name is John Michael. My question is, what are you advocating that we do? Because, number one, diplomacy in the context of genocide seems really misplaced. If you're losing 1,000 people a day, then diplomacy for the next 3 to 6 months, you can do the calculation. UN, we do not want another situation where the UN goes in, protects people, disarms people so that they can be slaughtered, as an example. Do we want the U.S. to go in like Somalia, where upon the first life that we lose, we immediately withdraw?
Great.
What should we do?
Who wants to?
I'm happy to.
Well, one of the things that we've been advocating organizationally is that you can't look at any one of the three components without looking at all three together. One of the reasons the humanitarian people are in such crisis is there's no protection. There needs to be a military, a security force, a peacekeeping force, making it safe for them to deliver their services. I don't agree with you. I think there is an element also of ramping up the diplomatic process. And I think it's some combination of the U.S. and the U.N. and others doing it. What we've advocated for is that the United Nations Secretary General appoint an envoy, a high-level envoy. I would say, ideally, a prominent, very prominent public figure close to the United States government.
Who might have spoken here earlier this evening.
And to really... in effect, say, in this one, the United Nations and the United States are together as opposed to being at war with one another, and that this is not business as usual. This is not Somalia. It's not Rwanda. There are going to be consequences diplomatically for governments that are not doing what they should. Now, the goal is to do two things. One, to create a dialogue within Darfur, which has not occurred and which needs to occur. But secondly, to create international pressure on governments that can influence the government of Sudan to say there has got to be a UN force that goes in to protect people. I don't think that's a surefire way of succeeding, but what is so frustrating to me right now is that you've got UN officials who say, boy, we've tried everything, we don't know what to do next. And you've got US government officials saying, we don't trust the UN. We're going to appoint a U.S. envoy, and they're going to coordinate U.S. policy. To do what? The United States is not going to send in troops by themselves, nor should they. There has to be some kind of a multilateral force under some umbrella. And we ought to be saying to leaders, both U.S. and U.N., this is a time where you have to stand on principle and go to the mat to get what's needed here, which is a direct intervention by a force of 25,000 people and a diplomatic solution and a humanitarian solution, all in a package. That's not happening right now.
Michael, just to be clear, then I'm going to ask Samantha if she wants to, should that force be armed?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Just want to make clear that right now, you know, they're not armed, the 7,000 on the ground. And Samantha, did you want to add to that?
I think since it's the most important question, what do we do? Maybe just add a few words. I mean, I think Mike's covered most of it. But the sort of protection piece, or the human security piece aspect of it, and the peace aspect, the political settlement aspect, are often treated as sort of separate commodities. To hear the Bush administration speak, you can't deal with the protection issue and the security issue until you've got a peace settlement. But the reality is no peace settlement is going to stick until people feel secure, first in the camps and then hopefully sooner rather than later as they move back to their homes. So Mike has talked about the essence of what this amounts to, which is a force of anywhere between, 25,000, a force of minimum of 25,000. So if you've got 7,500 African Union troops on the ground, that then raises the question of how do you ramp up that 7,500 to 25,000? The Sudanese government has said, we will not accept a United Nations force. It's imperialistic. It's colonial. It's, a stooge of George Bush. And sadly, the Bush administration has been largely alone internationally in arguing the contrary and in saying, no, it's not. Like, we're not even talking about being part of this force. What it's about is the very thing that you, Sudan, claim in having signed this peace deal that you are for, which is, bringing about stability. So that raises the question, then, how do we get from 7,500 to 25,000? The only way you're going to do that is if you get the Sudanese to say, we welcome a force, or we'll endure an international force. Why? Why can't we just invade? Well, because no member state of the United Nations wants to go into a peaceful Sudan, never mind make war for Darfur. So unless you get the Sudanese government's consent, which is, crazy, right, to go to the very genocidal government to ask for consent. But it's very, very doable. And what we have to do as a sort of, all these trains have to run simultaneously, and none have to come at the expense of the other, but we have to peel away Sudan's allies internationally. And that's where the diplomacy comes in. And that's where Kofi Annan and people who've been rhetorically, have had these sort of blips of commitment, but then have retreated, back into their bureaucracies. Getting people in the developing world to be part of this effort to peel away China, to peel away Egypt, to peel away Russia, to peel away France, countries you wouldn't expect to be aligned with Sudan, so that they feel isolated internationally and have to acquiesce to the deployment of these 25,000 troops. Then the second order question is, where do those troops come from? And we had this discussion in an earlier panel, but one of the great flaws now in the international system is the United States is out of commission. It's both overstretched and totally illegitimate internationally, especially when one thinks about operating in a Muslim country. It would probably attract more jihadis than it would protect Darfurians, I believe. And I think reasonable people can disagree about that, but I'm more reasonable than them. I'm kidding. No, but I'd love the United States to be the agent to both be the mobilizer of forces and the deployer of forces. But not only is it not going to happen for domestic political reasons, but I really think one would have to think very, very hard about deploying an American force into a Muslim country. If you break it, you own it, et cetera. We've lived that thing already. So then the question is, does the United States have enough legitimacy or enough summoning power to go to other member states of the United Nations and convince middle powers especially to play, to ramp up this 7,500, to round out that force? The largest troop contributing countries to UN peacekeeping in the last 5 years are Bangladesh, Uruguay, Pakistan, India, South Africa, Nigeria, Sri Lanka, Fiji. Nepal, Fiji. Okay, these are the countries we're talking about. We're not, Canada's not on that list. The Netherlands is not on that list. So how do we, as President Clinton said today, especially think about getting countries like Jordan, actually it's also on the list, Jordan, Turkey, Pakistan, Muslim countries that, where you could more easily get Sudanese acquiescence, while also rounding them out with the resources of middle powers like Canada, like the Netherlands, and with the lift and the money and so on of the United States and other countries that don't necessarily have to be on the ground to actually be making a difference. That's just to get the protection piece right. Then to get the peace right, again, this envoy and his clout and his attention span or her attention span is the key piece of this. Because Zelik, we can brag about how we've sent our Deputy Secretary of State to Sudan for 5 times, and he brags about how he spent more time in Darfur this year than he has with his family in New York. So what? You know, no one's going to remember that you went 5 times. All anybody's going to remember that 500,000 people died over the course of your administration rather than whatever it is now, 200,000. So getting, I mean, working the peace track and the protection track simultaneously is key, and peeling, isolating Sudan so it has to acquiesce, and then treating, having a donor conference. We always have donor conferences for humanitarian aid. We never have donor conferences for troop contributions. But what better way to get countries to actually put their, you know, their sort of African solutions for African problems, developing world solutions for developing world problems, put those principles to test than having them in the room with somebody like a President Clinton trying to work the seduction to make them cough up.
Susan.
I know you said no statements, but I have a little bit of information on this exact topic, then I will get to my question. I didn't hear President Clinton this year, but last year I got a hold of him in the parking lot, and we did a 10-minute thing for about 20 people about Darfur. And at that moment, he was going the next week to have lunch with Kofi Annan to discuss this very same thing. He was talking 15,000 African Union troops, etc. So I don't know what happened. Did he mention it today? It is this thing. And the second piece of it would be what Lord Alderdice said was how they solved Ireland was George Mitchell just sat there
right.
and said, I'm not leaving until it's done. Okay, so that's that. Now, to move to, that's the statement, I'm sorry.
Well, that was the statement. Okay, yeah. Now the question.
Now the question. Great. Well, one question is, did Clinton say what happened there? And number two is, aside from all this stuff, having been in the media, I know things have to become sexy to people in that term before they care. And in our country, Oprah is the person who takes and makes and can do things. Have you guys talked to her? Have you?
She did a thing on
Darfur. Well, George, you know, one thing isn't going to be enough. She's got to do a week and go and make a thing.
So one of you want to just answer this?
I do Oprah. Do you want to do the other piece?
You do Oprah, you do Clinton, okay?
Oprah.
Clinton didn't mention at all his meeting last year, if it happened. I assume it happened, but he didn't talk about it. He did say, and clearly feels, based on his own experience and his own failure to act in Rwanda, that we ought to be doing something more aggressively on Darfur. And what he suggested is that whether it's in the context of NATO or some other framework, there ought to be a military peacekeeping force constituted, and we ought to push forward as aggressively as we can. He didn't go into more detail that I could tell.
No.
I mean,
it was
more of a cri de coeur saying, we got to do something.
No, he had a plan and a number and a thing.
Okay. If he had a plan, he didn't tell us about it.
The other half, Samantha?
Just the Oprah Clooney half. One of the most surreal experiences of my life was I was sitting at a Mets Nationals game, and all the women in the audience can appreciate what an experience this was, and my phone rang, and I was playing hooky from Obama's office, and it was a number I didn't recognize, and I was terrified that it was Obama. So I almost didn't answer it, but I did.
Ooh.
And it was George Clooney. And he was on his way to Darfur, and I literally thought, I was like, do not compute, do not compute, do not. And but he went off, and he was, you know, I don't know, I mean, I didn't know much about him before, but he's incredibly rigorous. I mean, he had read everything and, you know, wanted to talk already before he even left, think about what the deliverables were on the way out, what he should be saying as soon as he, you know, crossed out of Darfur. I mean, there's no surprises actually waiting for you in Darfur, whether you're a journalist or a celebrity. You know, it's a little bit of the same old, unfortunately. And so thinking through the prescriptions, timing his trip very deliberately around the rally in Washington, and already knowing that he had lined up Oprah for as soon as he got back. Now, the surreal part of this, apart from getting the phone call in the first place and finally accepting that it wasn't, you know, one of my many, impersonator friends, was being in Obama's office when Clooney came back. He went with his father. There's no way, I should say, incidentally, for those of you who are skeptical of celebrity activism, there's actually no conceivable way to do Darfur light. Like, you have to get food poisoning. You have to almost get heat stroke. And there is a great risk that, you know, you're going to be confronted by some kind of, more often than not, a thief rather than necessarily an Arab militiaman. But, I mean, it is thug central right now, you know. So he went and got the obligatory food poisoning and got threatened to have his plane shot down and did all that and came back with the footage with his dad, went on Oprah. And here's the two aspects to this. The first is that he goes on Oprah, and here was going to be Darfur's moment with Middle America. And it's such a compelling story, and if you tell the story of the way that rape has been used as a tool of the war and that women going to get firewood and having to make these Sophie's choices between feeding their families and getting the wood they need to heat the humanitarian aid that the United States is giving them, but in so doing risking rape or staying home and being, you know, immune to rape, hopefully within a camp, but, you know, not being able to heat the humanitarian. I mean, you tell these stories, it's just, you know, Middle America is going to respond to this. But what Oprah does, I don't know what came over her, but she does an LRA. The first half of the hour is on the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, and it's all about, and she's talking, but she's clearly moved by it. It's children, and it's dreadful. I mean, it's, no comparative, again, atrocities or whatever. But she starts referring to it as a Holocaust, the worst Holocaust of our time, this, that, and the other. And then Clooney's on for the second segment. And I work these issues all the time. And by the time Clooney came on, I was like, ich kann nicht mehr, you know, I can't, you know, no more atrocities, you know, you can't. And so what she, in a way, you know, it was total compassion fatigue, even within a segment. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I was in Obama's office that day, and the phones rang off the hook. So. Mm-hmm. They rang off the hook, but in the sweetest way possible. It was literally like, you know, not to generalize, but housewives, you know, in Middle America calling up and saying, tell Senator Obama there's genocide in Darfur. Right. We just saw it on Oprah. Right.
Now we know it's true. Do something.
No, and not just now we know it's true. Now we know. We just learned that this thing is happening. And it just, you know, President Bush talks a lot about the filter, you know, and prefers local newspapers. We get Nick Kristof barely. I mean, the New York Times barely covers Darfur. Regional newspapers, television, I mean, they have not covered this at all. This was the first most Oprah watchers had ever heard of a genocide that had been going on for 3 years.
Thank you, George.
And thank you, George Clooney. And he brought at least half the people to the mall.
Yes, sir, please. And then we'll get someone from this side, because nobody on the right has asked anything yet. Yes, please.
My name is Arthur Thompson, and 150 years ago, you couldn't keep the Europeans out of Africa. There was copper, gold, diamonds, and they didn't give a damn if they're Muslims, animists, or anything else. They went. Now, all of a sudden, they're Muslims. We'd like to go, but you see, it might upset the Muslims. And what the Muslims think they are, they can just go kill people on that, using that as their cover. I really think, I'm totally interventionist to the United States, but what about our fat, sanctimonious European so-called allies that are over there having parties, while we basically defended them from the Soviets, we were the key player. Don't those people ever feel any responsibility to go back to Africa when they made so much money down there? That was my question.
I'm happy to answer, but I've talked too much already. Mike.
I would say, seriously, the European response on Darfur has been terrible, miserable. There are a variety of reasons. In general, European governments, I think, are much less attuned to these issues than they were 10 or 15 years ago. Some of them are conflicted. Samantha mentioned the French. The French have oil interests in Darfur, Alf Total, which is partly owned by the government. So I talked to the government minister for human rights of the French government, and I said, I'm a little concerned about the economic interests of some of the Security Council members. And she said, oh, no. When our foreign minister went, he talked about the genocide before he talked about Alf Total. And I said, no, I was talking about the Chinese and the Russians. It's really been, and part of it, unfortunately, this is one of the things that really weighs on me doing this work. You know, our engagement in Iraq, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, our own failings as a nation in terms of our own human rights record have turned potential allies into skeptics, cynics, and non-responsive participants. So much so that when we've tried to work with some activist groups in Britain, they tell us that the human rights community there doesn't want to take up Darfur because it's seen as an American issue.
But is that a reason or a pretext?
Well, it's both. You know, it's some combination. The fact
well,
it's
a reason. They're worrying about a couple hundred people, maybe 50 or 10 or 20, 30 people. And you took how many people are now dying in Darfur, say, a year?
Well, I think it's about 200,000 have died.
So is that pretty phony and hypocritical?
Look, I'm not defending it. I'm trying to explain. You asked a question. Yeah. No, I don't accept it for a moment. But what
we lead the way.
Well, I think realistically, if the United States isn't going to take a leadership role, and if the United States isn't going to figure out a way to work with the UN and those various countries that Samantha mentioned that could constitute a multilateral force, we're not going to succeed.
Well, the UN's not going to do anything, I guarantee you that. I
want to get other people
sure.
in, too.
Please,
anybody on the right over here? Yes, sir, please.
We could also take
My name is Kevin Morgan.
Yeah, I think that's what we'll do. Yeah,
when you look at the situation in Rwanda and Darfur, two appalling calamities, and it seems that the real public attention to the issues was after the problems were really established, the genocide was established, and the kinetics of the response is just horrifying. So it seems to me that there are two issues here. There's one is what to do about Darfur, but the second is what template to develop to intervene in other situations before they become established genocides.
Great question.
And so what should we be doing? Because it seems we should be active on both tracks.
Well, that's a great. What I'd like to do now is put three or four questions on the table. Let Michael and Samantha respond to them, and then I'll wrap it up with a final comment. Yes, please.
Last year, in the space of 5 weeks, 700,000 people were displaced. Now, what I'm saying in essence is that whilst the crisis in Darfur is there, it's factual, and it deserves every amount of energy that you put into it, what concerns me is why so much attention is paid to that, and so little attention is paid to the Congo and to Zimbabwe. My question is, why is it that Darfur has managed to get this profile in America, and these other two very serious human rights issues have not?
Great. Rob?
Several years ago, Colin Powell labeled the situation in Darfur as a genocide. Then the Bush administration somewhat backed off. And I think that Eastern Sudan is kind of known as a terrorist haven. Could there be any validity to the speculation that the Bush administration has traded inaction in Darfur for possible terrorism intelligence from Khartoum?
I think I'd like to. Well, let's get these two questions if they're quick
let's
on the table. You want to take these three? You think they're not just yes, no questions?
No.
Let's take these three because they're very rich. I'm sorry we can't get everybody in. I'd love to, but let's take these three and give some response. You want to start, Samantha, this time?
Sure. I guess working backwards, on the G word question or on the temperamental Bush administration engagement, I don't think there's any question that the Bush administration's primary objective on planet Earth right now is counterterrorism. And to the degree that counterterrorism has a rival in Sudan in terms of national security objectives or national objectives, that rival would be solidifying the North-South agreement between Khartoum and rebels and Christians in the South. So there are two issues that are more important to the Bush administration in Sudan than Darfur. The only reason Darfur has spiked in the way that it has, and you're right to say that it's been spasmodic engagement, is this domestic pressure by evangelicals who made the turn, to their eternal credit, from mobilizing around the atrocities that were occurring and being committed against Christians in the South to actually saying, you know what, we'd love to sort of will Darfur away and focus on the South and Christians, but, you know, a government that's committing genocide in one part of the country probably isn't a terribly reliable interlocutor in the other part of the country. And so people like Frank Wolf and Sam Brownback, who've been, you know, real leaders on the North-South issue. And this gets just to, this wasn't one of the questions just asked, but to the European issue. I mean, the Europeans are no different. European governments are no different from the United States in terms of their orientation. They're looking out for their national interests. The difference is, and this is a very important difference, and it needs to change in Europe, European constituencies or European citizens don't feel that they have a stake in their foreign policy. They don't, and that's even more so the more Europeanized Europe becomes, the more removed citizens feel from the conduct of the European Union, the more that European governments have an alibi to say, well, we care about Darfur, but it's the European Union. When we get to Brussels, then things change and it gets diluted. But in America, this is crazy. I mean, what you guys are, what are you doing here? What are you doing on the ball? Like, the idea that we can change the Bush administration's approach to Sudan when all these other national priorities are at stake, it's a uniquely American conceit. It's beautiful. And in some ways, sadly, it's the flip of the moralism that has run awry, you know, in the Bush administration in a sort of messianic, you know, fervor, is that idea that young people have and that these different domestic constituencies have that they can actually, you know, inject a dose of regard for human consequences into American foreign policy. It's incredible. But in any event, so, yes, I think there's no question that if the Bush administration had its way, it would develop a much, cozier relationship with Khartoum on counterterrorism. It has famously flown Saleh Ghosh, the head of the intelligence community, to the United States to have discussions and consultations. Bin Laden, of course, hung out in Sudan. You know, no one in this administration has forgotten that. So basically what it tries to do is have its cake and eat it too. You know, cater to the domestic constituencies when we rise up and force the administration to do so. And then, you know, in more traditional realpolitik terms, maintain those relationships that enable us to pursue our more traditional objectives. To David's question, and maybe about Zimbabwe and I guess, you know, there's an old expression in sort of Holocaust literature, which is, whose blood is redder? You know, and this kind of comparative victimhood that goes on an awful lot. And I don't think you intended it, but, you know, the goal is not less attention to Darfur. The goal is far more attention to Zimbabwe, more attention to Congo, and you know, I think we've alluded to some of the sources of mobilization on Darfur, that it had more natural allies because of the Christian presence in the South, and because the U.S. had already engaged on the North-South process. The Bush administration had already invested its credibility. So it was sort of tainted a little bit more when Darfur broke out and atrocities started being committed because we'd already invested our prestige. We've invested nothing on Congo. We've invested nothing on Zimbabwe. And each of them, I think, have their own reasons for being kind of off-putting for advocates. In Zimbabwe, it's the original sin that it was white people getting kicked off farms, and that didn't kind of resonate in the way that other crimes have. The Mbeki problem cannot be overstated. The fact that he claimed ownership over Zimbabwe, and so there was a sense that someone was in charge, even though being in charge just meant looking the other way and demanding that everybody else look the other way. And in Congo, you know, with advocacy, what's the expression in philosophy? It's can implies ought. You know, knowing what you can do about Congo, if we actually had a Congo plan, we're hard up enough for a Darfur plan, but if we had a Congo plan and felt that it was sortable, if you knew how to disaggregate disease from militia, you know, but it is so overwhelming to people. And as big as Sudan is, Darfur creates the impression that there's actually something that you can do with an identifiable set of perpetrators that I don't think people have latched onto in Congo at all. That very 4 million, it should heighten the activism, but it just makes people, I think, fall back on their heels. So again, you know, we got to think about the template, and maybe Mike can address the issue of the template and others.
Yeah.
Thank you, Samantha.
I just want to add, I'm going to respond to you as well, but I want to just say a couple things about the constituency here. Samantha has mentioned, and it's absolutely right, that one of the driving forces has been the evangelical Christians, conservative Christians, who were very involved in the South and have been a real influential sector with this administration. The other aspect, which has been, I think, probably equally important, has been the engagement of the Jewish community. The rally that Samantha mentions at the mall was a substantial amount of the organizing was done by Jewish church synagogues and community centers, particularly in the East Coast and Midwest. Those are good things, but they also, to me, suggest a challenge that we now face. It is really important as we ramp this up and say, how do we extend the pressure on Congress and on the administration that mainstream Christian churches, Catholic Church, African American community, the African American community made such a difference in the anti-apartheid movement. They drove the process and they made it happen. And there really is a need to engage and mobilize. And I don't think we, the advocates, have done enough to do that. So I see we have some solid support in some currently influential, well-organized communities, but it's got to be made more mainstream. So that's on the security question. I was actually in a meeting in the National Security Council 6 months ago or a year ago when they started saying to me, you know, the Sudanese are really helping us on the war on terror. You know, they really know bin Laden. I say, yeah, they know bin Laden because they took him in. What does that tell you about who they are? So there's a kind of weird mentality that goes on in our government, and we've got to challenge that. On the issue of how to create some structures going forward, both at prevention and then dealing with these crises when they hit, there was a proposal, David talked about this earlier, David Coulthard, put forward to the UN a couple of years ago by Gareth Evans and some others, calling on the UN to set up essentially a system of protection, a responsibility to protect. There has been a range of proposals saying there ought to be a permanent peacekeeping force within the UN so you don't have to invent it from scratch. It still begs the question of how is it going to be authorized? And I think the biggest challenge we face is the dysfunction of the UN Security Council, the veto of the five superpowers, and the fractious nature of the world politics. And so when we're talking about a military or a peacekeeping presence that can be mobilized, the Europeans can do it in a NATO context. The question is, can you create something new that allows us to get beyond the impasse? I'm not sure the answer today is yes, but it's something we ought to be thinking about and working on. And I think clearly, you know, people in the human rights business are in the early warning business. I can tell you 10 places in the world that are, you know, ripe for this kind of behavior in the future. And again, it's a question of how much time, how much energy. But part of our role is to raise the flag and say, this is one of those places we ought to be paying attention to now and trying to prevent this from escalating into something that's catastrophic.
I just want to regrettably, I'm bound by time, and Cameron, I'd love to call upon you, but maybe some of us can stay afterwards. I just would love to, and I apologize, but a lot of people wanted to ask questions. I'd love to just say in wrapping up, and there's no wrapping up to this. We've learned a lot. I just want to add my own piece to this. While the two of you are speaking, I think of Martin Luther King in the Birmingham jail, his famous letter. And he writes, "Time is neutral, but lately I've come to believe that the people of ill will use their time much more constructively and strategically than the people of goodwill." I think Martin Luther King was 100% right. And I just, and maybe it's saying it in different words, and maybe it goes back to your question, David. One can't look at which blood is redder. These are all terrible things in genocide. I'm very grateful that the American people are becoming more and more aware of Darfur, and this is the time for us, for all of us as human beings, to draw the line in the sand. That we're going to do it politically, we're going to do it in a humanitarian way, we're going to do it through human rights, But this is a time for our generation. We're going to draw the line in the sand with Darfur. For that to happen, we've got to do a lot of the things Michael and Samantha have been talking about. A lot of you work in that arena. Cameron works in that arena. A lot of people here have a lot of great ideas. But we're going to have to do it strategically. We're going to have to do it focused. And we're going to have to do it with great resolve that no one can stop us. Because ultimately, if we don't stop it now, who are we? What can be said about us as humans? And what will ever lead to a paradigm of preventing it? There's great work to do. We need each other. I hope that we can work together more strategically. And I guess just in the final thing I would say is I'm reminded of, and this is what I hope to see, because there's many forums like this where people come together, call a couple people tomorrow, talk to them about it. We need a real coalition, not just of evangelicals and of Jews. As a Jew, by the way, I don't go to any more synagogues and speak, because the Jewish community is doing a pretty good job. We need to get to the African-American churches, to the Muslim community, I would add, to mainstream America for this to work. But we have to go about it. Sometimes people ask me about humanitarian work. Like sometimes people say, do you get paid? No, we do all this for free. We get water over there for free. We feed people for free. I remember when Michael Milken got sick. Some of you may remember this. When he got prostate cancer, he had the wealth to bring in 10 of the best prostate doctors in the world. He's still living and thriving. I think we can deal with this to bring minds like Michael and Samantha and others in a room and bring in political leaders, economic leaders, people from the arts, stars, and say once and for all, how are we going to work together? Because we got to stop this now, because we can't leave this legacy for our children. So first, I want to thank all of you for coming out on a Friday night and listening. And I especially want to thank Samantha and Michael for your wonderful work. Keep it up.
Thanks for watching.
I'll give you an example of this time and a reason for us.
Oh, no.
So the first thing was,